session number 21561, Reel 4.
John Hayes, Reel 4.
Well, the next task we had to carry out was this business of crossing the Rhine. As I've said before, I'm always concerned that we didn't get in a rut like our fathers had with in the Great War, where battles in trench warfare, and I was always concerned that once we crossed the Rhine, I felt that we were on our way to Berlin. Anyhow, we at that time, it was the march, coming up towards the march, and I was with our crew out on various jobs in Holland and up near Goch and Kleve, which were two early German towns that had been captured. Our crew were making their way. The infantry had advanced, and the engineers had laid pontoons across the Rhine, and tanks were going across, and we were on our way up to try and find a typhoon which had landed, and our job, as I said before, was to try and repair them and get them back to their base, or wherever their base was at that time. Anyhow, we got it with our truck. We crossed the Rhine, and I'm sure the town was called Emmerich. And my memory of it is that we went across this pontoon and came up the other side, and the town was completely destroyed. As we drove up, we drove across bricks and rubble. Tanks had been before us. We were following their tracks. And I was just, it reminded me of a place called Lisieux in Normandy, which also had been just obliterated. And the only thing that stood in Lisieux was the green-spired church. And here we were in Emmerich, was a sort of a repetition of all this destruction. And the British Royal Military Police had got across the Rhine, and they put a big notice up, obviously well prepared. And it said, "You are now about to enter the uncivilized world. Be on your guard." Now, this was a warning to all of us, because, you know, we weren't quite sure how the Germans would react to us. And I have three sisters at home, younger than myself, and brothers as well, but, you know, my sisters and always had good relationship with members of my family and my siblings. And I remember, as we, in our old Crossley, we'd had the front blown off, by the way, earlier on, you know, with a shell fire, but the motor was still going all right, but we never had any windscreen. That had been blown away. But we still had the turret, where the old sergeant used to sit and watch for any sort of trouble, you know, ahead. And I saw a German girl walking towards on the pavement, and I could see the girl was absolutely shaking with fear at the sight of British soldiers. And I thought, what on earth's wrong with her? You know, I couldn't believe it. And it's only later I learned that some of these Germans were petrified of what was going to happen to them. They must have been told, you know, that we were probably uncivilized. Nevertheless, when we got into Nordheim, was one of their first places we went to, and we were not allowed to talk to any Germans. You know, there was a fraternization ban on. And, of course, the children, you couldn't help but talk to children, and we used to give them cigarettes and chocolate, you know, for their parents. But at that time, I mentioned about my uncle, but I know I kept looking at the French prisoners who were walking back home to France from their prison camps. I was always still looking for my Uncle Bill. You know, this was, to me, was a mission to try and find him. But of course, as I say, Mother had written and a note to me saying that he was home, and we were all much relieved about it. Anyhow, as far as the Germans go are concerned, I had no hatred for them because I'd never met any Germans. I remember saying to myself as I come up through Emmerich, well, I've never met a German, and what are they like, and what's the language like? But slowly, you know, I began to realise that these people were having problems, because there was an incident where, first of all, we got to Lingen, a place called Lingen, and there's a canal there, the Lingen-Ems Canal, and we, you know, stripped down and we had a bath in this canal. Now, I'm talking about March, and it wasn't too cold, but well, I remember saying, here I am bathing in the Lingen-Ems Canal, and we'd heard all this business that was going on with the bombing earlier on in the war when the Royal Air Force used to bomb the area. And what happened was we used to take turns in driving this Crossley truck, and Sergeant Toshery, he used to sit up and always had an eye for trouble. He had a road shotgun, if you like. He had a rifle up there, and just in case we were running into a trouble. This is where we used to go out on our work. And he shouted out to me, there's trouble up there. He said, keep your eyes peeled, Johnny. This is what he used to say to me. And I'm driving along, and suddenly I felt a bump on the left wing of the cab, where he was. So I said, what the hell was that? I said. So he said, hang on a minute. He said, I'm driving very slowly. So he said to me, you've hit a bloody donkey. You know, I'd hit a donkey had run out from somewhere, and there were a load of women chasing this donkey. And I'd obviously knocked the donkey over. So I drove on for about 50 yards, and I pulled up. So I got out, and the sergeant got out, and the other two of the crew were sitting in the back. So he said to them, cock your rifles ready in case we have trouble. So we went back, and there's a group of women, and they were cutting up this donkey, and they had bags and bowls, and they were cutting him in pieces, children as well with the mothers. And they were putting this donkey's meat in their bowls and bags. And off they went. And I have to say this, within about 4 or 5 minutes, there was nothing left. They were so hungry, these people, that they were looking for anything. And it's just by chance that they were chasing this donkey. And he ran out in front of our wagon. And there it was. We supplied them with a meal. But that sort of stuck in my mind, how starving these people were. And you couldn't help but feel sorry for them, you know, that you look around and this girl, I go back to this girl again, who was shaking. I think, my God, I've got sisters this girl's age. And I would, you know, hate to think that anything like that would happen to them. And from that moment onwards, I've made up my mind, and I have to tell you that I have a Christian background. I was brought up with my mum, you know, as a Christian, used to go to Sunday school, that I was going to hate nobody from then on. And that's how it was with me. And I got to know German people. Well, we moved into Hildesheim. I'll just tell you another little story. One of our chaps, sadly, right at the last day of the war, we moved into a field at a place called Linden. And the poor devil, Dennis Crowder, he got hit with a missile from a flak tower, and he lost his life, and he's buried in the Reichwald Forest. He was the last man we lost in the campaign. That was very sad. He came from Gloucester. He was a fitter like myself in another crew. So that was rather sad. But I'd made up my mind afterwards. I was not going to hate anybody. We went on to Hildesheim. We'd had trouble there because there was a burgomaster there who was apparently a bit of a Nazi, and he wasn't going to give up. And while the typhoons had to go in there and give him a shake up, and eventually they surrendered. Then we moved into the airfield, which was close to Hildesheim. we stayed there, and the war came had come to a close. We were disbanded, the unit was disbanded. Some of the older members of the unit, incidentally, I was one of the youngest, if not the youngest in the unit. Some were sent back, the older ones were sent back to UK. Others were sent on for service in the Far East. But I was with a drafted man ready to go to Berlin. And I was one of the first British Royal Air Force airmen to enter Berlin. You know, we had trouble with the Russians. They wouldn't let us in there. And we moved in and we took over Royal Air Force Gatto, or Gato as it's in Europe. And when we got there, the Russians were still there. They'd only just buried some of the German soldiers that had been laying out on the fields around and in the forest around there. And they buried them in very temporary graves and stuck their tin hats on top of crosses. And it was the sort of aftermath of a battle around Gato, and the Luftwaffe Academy had been blown up. This is all alongside the River Spray. And yeah, we eventually got into Gato and we got to the hangars and we engaged a lot of German civilians to clean up the place. The place was alive with rats. The cellars were full of rats. And of course they'd been feasting off the bodies and things, you know, that had been left about. And I felt, you know, when I used to see these graves of these German soldiers, I thought, well, crumbs, you know, what a terrible way to go right at the very last day of the war. Some of these chaps had been on the Russian front and all over, and then suddenly, you know, they come to an end there. Anyhow, we cleaned up Gatto and started to get the station operational. We were short of furniture and things, and anyhow, it started, when was it? By June, you know, things were going. There was a victory parade in Berlin. That was attended by all the dignitaries. They flew out from UK. There was Churchill, Montgomery. They all came up there, came up in their Dakotas. And we had the airfield operational. And I remained in Berlin until 1947.
What were conditions like in Berlin during the occupation of Germany?
When we arrived there, I would say it was appalling. The bombing had been catastrophic. It really had. I mean, everywhere you went, there were buildings down, and there were gangs of women clearing away the bricks and rubble just to make the roads passable. The infrastructure, they were trying very hard. You know, Germans worked very hard to try and get the electricity and the water and get that all going throughout Berlin. But everywhere around you was devastation. And amidst all this, you know, I went into a place in the centre of Berlin where there was a hospital. And I don't know, I used to say to my mother, you know, about, because I never used to go chasing girls when I was a teenager, you know, we sort of mixed with them, but I never got sort of serious with any girls, really. And I remember my mother saying to me, I asked her about how she met my father, and she said, when you meet her, you'll know. She said, you'll know, you'll just know. And this happened to me, because I went into this hospital, German hospital, and most of a lot of rubble it was, and in the dispensary, there was this girl, and she was just getting up some steps to get some medicine off a shelf. She was in a white coat, very clean looking, and she reminded me of an actress, Alice Faye, that all little boys we used to dream about when we were boys. And anyhow, to cut a long story short, I married her 12 months later, and we lived in Berlin. And contrary, father had warned me not to have anything to do with foreign women. And when I went back to home again, a couple of years later, I was married, and I just had a newborn son who was born in Schmargendorf. I was then working for the Royal Air Force and also for the Foreign Office, doing some work with their intelligence service, which went travelling into the Russian zone. They were asking for volunteers to go into Russian zone. They all went to go, but didn't mind going to the American zone and the French zone. But the Russian zone, they weren't very keen on. But me, you just volunteered for it, and I was given a Mercedes-Benz diesel car, a chauffeur, and he had special military passes, I did. And for the commandantura, as they called it, I acted as a courier inside the Russian zone. I travelled from time to time with them, pulled guns on me, arrested the driver, but always threatened them with diplomatic pressures and things, and managed to get through without any bother, real bother.
What job were you supposed to be doing?
Well, actually, my job was a courier inside the Russian, taking messages, you see, to these Russian generals. But, of course, there was a terrible tension. If I can tell you that I also belonged to the church out there. I used to go to church quite regularly, and I was very friendly with the Royal Air Force Padre, and also a German pastor who lived in Kladov. And a group of us wanted to start a moral leadership course in a place called the Fauerninsel. It's at the Peacock Island, and it's where Goebbels had a big home. He had a big sort of retreat in a very beautiful spot on the Spree. And when we tried to get things going there, because it's so close to the Russian zone, the Russians, came down on hard on us. They thought we were trying to build a spy network with them. There was a terrible suspicion on everybody there at the time. So that had to go by the board. But the whole time it was suspicion. They never trusted the British. And we were forever looking over our shoulder. Stalin, you see, had made up his mind. I'm quite sure that the British were not going to stay there. And of course, I left there in the February of 1948 with my wife and son. And very soon afterwards, of course, the Berlin airlift started. And I think that was an attempt by the Russians to get the Allies out of Berlin, which they never succeeded in doing.
I think later you had some experiences in Kenya during Mau Mau, if you can tell me about those, please.
Yes. Well, what happened with the Foreign Office was the Labour government, as it was then, there was Mr. Bevin, he was Foreign Minister, and they had to make drastic cuts, expenditure cuts, with the expenditure for Germany, because we were spending a lot of money trying to help the Germans to rehabilitate themselves, and we, of course, were living on Marshall Aid from America. So anyhow, it was a question of economies all round, and unfortunately, I was made redundant and sent back to UK. Now, when I got back to UK, I mean, I'd had a good education in the Royal Air Force, and I didn't want to go back to manual work. I didn't want to be a fitter in my sort of civilian life. So what happened was my brother was with an airline, and he managed to put me onto a job at the American Express, and I joined them on April the 1st, 1948, and as a trainee, a commercial trainee. Now, American firms, if you work for American firms, in those days particularly, they're hard taskmasters, and you've really got to work for your money, and you've got to produce results, and you've got to become very efficient. So it was a good school of learning for me. You had to really work hard, and they never overpaid you. I was never overpaid. In fact, I've kept all my income tax certificates for the 4 years I was with American Express, and look back on it as an exercise in learning about commerce. What happened was that with the commercial experience and also my Royal Air Force experience, I decided I was either going to Bermuda, South Africa, or East Africa. And I had relatives by marriage who lived in Kenya, and one was in the veterinary laboratory out in Kenya, in Nairobi. And I eventually got a job through British Airways, British Overseas Airways as it was then. I phoned up the head man there, and he said, are you married? So I said, yes. He said, well, that's half your chances gone. Any children? Yes, one. That's another 25%. I'll send you a form. So I filled in the form. A few weeks later, the commercial manager of a new airline, was starting a new airline in East Africa, was in London. He interviewed me, gave me the job, and off we went to Kenya. And I went in there, first of all, on the traffic side, what they call a traffic officer. And we started to purchase aeroplanes, bought some old DC-3s from the Desert Air Force surplus. We had two old Dominies from 1932, de Havilland Dominies, six-seaters, biplanes they were, DC-3s, and from there we started an airline, and we started, and what happened was that the day I arrived in Kenya.
Which year was that?
This was in 1952, October 52. The Mau Mau Rebellion started, and the day I arrived, an emergency was declared. Now, if I tell you, when I landed on the runway at Eastleigh Airport, I had £14.10 in my pocket, which was my income tax refund. And that's all I had. I'd sent my wife to Berlin to go and visit her father and take her son before she came out. And I thought, right, my bridges are burnt, I can't go back. And I stayed in Kenya. I was there for about 2 weeks. I moved from the New Stanley Hotel to the Mayfair Hotel, which was a place called Parklands in Nairobi. Lying in bed there one night, knock on the door. A chap there, police officer, European. He said, I understand you're an ex-serviceman. I said, yes, I'm Royal Air Force. He said, we need you. Will you go down to the church hall, the Baptist church hall, swear an allegiance to Her Majesty? You're now a member of the Kenya Police Reserve. Well, I was given the rank of special officer, but I had to work on a part-time basis because I had my airways work to do, you see, in the town, and also at the Nairobi Airport, Nairobi West Airport, that was a small domestic airport, and also at Eastleigh, which was the main airport, which was used later by the Royal Air Force. And as the emergency built up, of course, we became very busy. my job with the Kenya Police Reserve was meeting up, usually rendezvousing at midnight, usually. When my family came out, I sort of made sure they were locked up safely. We had some good secure premises in Nairobi, flats they were. And then how we would work was we'd do sweeps, as they called them, on boys' quarters, that's servant boys' quarters, pulling out any kikuyu that were hiding there and infiltrating to do damage in Nairobi.
How could you identify them?
Well, the only way we'd do them was we'd go do a sweep and take in all the servants. And we had a fluent Kikuyu-speaking officer. And we would sort out those who were genuine, and we knew the or the European owners would employed them, would vouch for them. But other strangers who were there, they were always put on the back of the lorry and taken back to the Parklands police station and interrogated. If there was a further suspicion, they were taken up to Limuru, where there was a camp there where the British Army used to deal with them. But the whole time what was happening was they were killing European children, and they were taking these Mau Mau oaths, and within the oath it said that they had to kill a European. Well, of course, it didn't say how big the European was. Of course, being what they were, they used to kill little children. And there was a terrible case there where they murdered some ruck children in a farming community. Anyhow, what I used to do was, at weekends, I would, and when I was free, I would go up country to the farms and take my wife and son with me. And one particular farm we used to go to was in Gilgil. Right out in the bush, and this chap was growing pyrethium, and other mixed arable he was doing. And I used to go on there with a shotgun, an elephant gun actually, and be on guard, you know, to look after his family. He had some children as well. And it was a general sort of network of farms looking after one another. Then I'd make my way back on Monday morning to continue with my airways work. In Nairobi itself, when I was there, always slept. See, security, I'd learned all this in the Royal Air Force. Security was lie on the bed, facing the door, gun in the shoe on your right-hand side, wife on the other side on another bed, so behind the wall, usually protected, and our son in another room where I could see, get a sort of clear vision where I could fire anybody that came in there. So they were the sort of precautions and conditions. But you see, we burned our bridges, and I was determined to stay in East Africa and to do the job I went out there for, was to build an airline. Fortunately, the rebellion subsided. It was unsuccessful. Kenya was going to get independence, and I remember this relative of mine at the vet lab telling me, "You're all right for 10 years. And that's exactly how long it lasted. 10 years later, Jomo Kenyatta was made the president. And they could have achieved all that peacefully because it was the intention of Mr. Attlee and the Labour government. They wrote a book on it. I'd read it beforehand, saying that it was their intention to give independence to all these colonies, and that's exactly what was done. I was in Nairobi for a while, and then we were developing up in Uganda, and I went up there and took charge of operations in Kampala. I was in charge there for a while. And then as things progressed and started to build up, I then moved down to Tanganyika and started to concentrate on some lucrative work for us. It was to earn revenue. And that was flying pilgrims to Mecca at the Hajj period every year. And I concentrated on that work for the best part of 10 years. From Dar es Salaam right down to Mtwara, Lindi, all those ports along the African coast. I worked all of them. Opened up the airport at Malindi, which is now a thriving airport. It was an old coral strip when I was went to it. And we put DC-3s in there. Slowly we built it up. It wasn't a sort of game cap in hand to governments asking for money. We had old DC-3s. We had good engineers who kept them flying. We had a safety record second to none. The only snag was that one in 1950,